Howdy, writers! KJ here, staring ahead into fall 2021 and trying to ignore the fact that it feels like staring into the abyss. Stop. Wait. That's really not where I meant to go with that. What I want to focus on is the other part of fall. Crunchy leaves, pumpkins, apples, school supplies, fresh starts. If that's the part of fall you want more of, maybe it's time for a new beginning as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator say they begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and often end up being booked months in advance. Sound like fun? Agreed. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the podcast about writing all the things. Short things, long things, books, articles, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about finding ways to sit down and get that work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, and my new book, The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. And you can find my work at lots of places, The New York Times and The Washington Post and The Atlantic, among others.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my new one is called Boyfriend. You can find it anywhere ebooks are sold.
And I am KJ Delantonia, author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, the nonfiction book, How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor of The Motherlode at The New York Times. I have another novel coming out next summer. It is called In Her Boots. Y'all will, I'm sure, hear more about that later. And I've pretty much given up on freelancing at the moment, so can't find my work anywhere. So there.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about that the other day, you know, how you start to get that pressure of, ooh, I haven't written anything in a while. I'm becoming irrelevant. I've got to write something. And I've been feeling that pressure a little bit lately, but haven't actually submitted anything in a little while. So
that has, and I have felt that pressure. I know exactly what you mean. That has evaporated in my new, I am a novelist and I don't have to do this sense. Maybe, or maybe it's just temporary.
You know what?
Who knows?
You know what really gets the,
I'm gonna take it.
You know what really gets the juices flowing though for wanting to take on new things is having a deadline for something big. I have a deadline for something really big coming up on October 1st. And some evil person in my Twitter timeline, someone I really love, but man, she's evil, let me know about an essay contest, and the deadline is September 15th. We are recording this on September 12th, which means I have 3 days to finish it and get it postmarked. But I'm really excited about it, but it's not at all what I should be doing right now. But in the usual way it goes, the minute you have something large and looming, either you start cleaning everything there is to clean, or you find new things to write, or you see that squirrel across the yard and have to go chase it. That's my sort of idea.
Yeah.
So there we
yeah.
are.
Yeah. Now, I get it. So I have come today to the podcast with a topic, something I would really like to specifically talk to you guys about. I have been thinking a lot about Stephen King's quote where he says, write with the door closed, rewrite with the door open. And I've been thinking about that in part because I think that the way I have interpreted that, at least, isn't working very well for me. I think I need to write. I need to at least come up with what I'm writing with the door open. Serena and I spent a lot of the day yesterday hashing over some plot points for the two of us. I have been hashing over this third book that I'm writing. I intend to hash it over with Jenny Nash. In fact, we're gonna hash it over in a on That's why I have a deadline for it. I'm supposed to come up with an email, or I'm sorry, an outline, and hash it over with her. I'm going to run it by my agent. And the reason for this is that I feel like on In Her Boots, I kind of grabbed an idea and went off running and ended up writing a lot of stuff that didn't work very well. And I'm wondering if I talk about it more, if I can sidestep mm-hmm. that. So thoughts. Do we, should we huddle in our little rooms and write and then come out, or?
What do you think Stephen King meant by that quote? Just not to share it until it's already done on the page?
Yeah, I actually do think he meant, don't tell. And I have felt like I've felt that way. Like, don't. Because ideas sound stupid. Like, it doesn't matter how great the idea is. You're like, well, I was thinking, what if there is this woman and she couldn't get married because her parents were really super annoying and she had all these sisters and they didn't have any money. And also she was kind of stuck up about herself. And then she met this stuck up dude. And like, he said insulting things about her. They all sound stupid. It doesn't, it all. So I have really tended to keep my ideas like close to the wrap to avoid sounding stupid. And I'm not, I actually think that's wrong.
I think what he means based on the context and based on other things that are in that book is that he talks about that for him, writing is most alive. Writing is best when he refers to it as being skin on skin, that it is immediate. It is furtive. It is, you can't let an idea go for too long, except he's done that with some books that he just didn't feel like he was ready to write. But for him, it seems like his ideas happen and they are really fertile. And the minute he starts talking about them with other people, they grow less so. And I get that. I do get that for the reasons that you mentioned and for the reasons that we don't talk about the stuff we're going to talk on the podcast before we do the podcast, because it becomes less fresh.
Mm-hmm.
But the inside outline, the outline you were talking about with Jenny, the inside outline, I think, is really, really useful, too. So I don't know that one is right or wrong, because obviously we've talked about this before. Some people are pantsers, some people are plotters. Mm-hmm. Stephen King is writing about universes that he's making up all, he can break the space-time continuum if he wants to, as long as he has internal logic to his universe. You write about the universe that we also really do live in. So I think there's
this is not really about Stephen King.
No,
it's
of course
really
not.
Just about should we share our ideas before we write them, and if so, when in the process, and why, and and how?
Well, a counter argument perhaps is offered by that book called The Idea that mm-hmm. you recommended on another episode. And The Idea is written by a wonderful screenwriter, a successful screenwriter, who posits that, so many people waste a lot of time writing things that aren't going to work. And if they had talked it over earlier in the process, it would have been beneficial. And I've been feeling that way for a lot of years, actually. First of all, it's scary to share an idea because, unless I'm sharing it with you in the car on the way to dinner last night, like, there's the thought that like somebody could take this and write it and I'll lose it. But of course, that's only one reason not to share something, but it's one that I got over a long time ago, because a lot of ideas are just plain hard to execute, and you have to be really committed, to see something through to a book length or film length thing. So that stopped bothering me a long time ago. And when I'm forced to articulate why I like an idea, in the car, and I'm like, well, it's going to be this. But here's why it's not dumb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really helpful.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, I have another quote to throw into the mix, which is, this is from a book I have just started reading, so don't know yet if it's going to be good, but it came highly recommended. It's called Great Stories Don't Write Themselves by Larry Brooks. And actually, the quote's not really from the book. He's quoting someone else, but he's quoting someone who said, when you have an idea, run.
Yeah.
And he's like, not towards it, away. Because, you know, if it doesn't chase you, then it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
That's his theory. And I was like, that's an interesting way to put it, too. I think being forced to articulate why you like the idea or what you would do with it while feeling incredibly stupid can, it can help you either to cement it or figure out what you like about it or follow it down a rabbit hole, or it can help you. Like I really decided not to do something after hashing it over with a couple of people that I don't normally talk about this stuff with, including my husband, who's not someone I would normally share an idea with, because he'd make me feel stupid. Not that he does that, but
yeah,
but he was right. It was a bad one.
It's like trying to sometimes talking about ideas that are not fully formed in our heads, and I do tend to verbalize not fully formed ideas just because I tend to work through things by saying them out loud. But like, for example, this essay, my mother-in-law actually just texted me and asked what I was writing about for this essay contest. And I told her and I said, I swear it's something interesting. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I can't go into the whole thing. I did go into the whole thing with Tim because I had just worked it out in the car coming home on a long 4-hour drive. And I worked the whole thing out and I found that telling him what it was helped solidify it for me. But that's not usually the case. But you also have a real world example of time wasted on Chicken Sisters before you worked with Jenny. You did some work before you did Inside Outline that you said helped really clarify for you.
I wouldn't say that was about the idea or not having. I mean, it did help me clarify. Mm-hmm. But that one, it kind of worked. It worked to write it and then go over it with someone. But I'm just trying to figure out. Well, so let's talk about, so you're working on a new nonfiction idea that is still in the ether. Like, you don't know which way you're going to angle it. But I know that you have talked this over with a couple people, and I would love to hear, like, you know, how did that go? And how did you feel after, you know, hearing, well, maybe not this, yeah, or that, you know, this? Or
I think you have to have some faith in the people that you talk to, because and some of the people I had to talk to about this idea because I needed their commitment to be a part of it, to at least be a counselor for me through this process for the new nonfiction book. And so what I said to them was, look, I'm writing this proposal and here's very loosely what this thing is. And as you know, as someone who writes nonfiction, you know, someone who writes academic papers, sometimes you have this loose idea. That's all this is right now. So here's my loose idea. And I have to have a little bit of faith in people to be able to deal with the fact that it's not fully fleshed out. What I have found is if I don't trust the people I'm telling about those things, they start giving me all kinds of advice about what it should be before I'm even to that point yet. So I do have to talk about some of the things because I need some level of commitment from some people to, you know, help me along the way. And the thing that I love that you said was the best ideas are the ones that follow you. Everything I've ever written that I've really loved has been an idea that I had that I didn't even need to jot down because it kept sort of fermenting, fomenting, whatever, along the way. And it became something bigger and bigger. And it came together in its own way in the back of my head while I wasn't actively thinking about it, but reading other things. So that for me is an important part of the process. But I do have to talk about some aspects. And then of course I have to talk to Lori, our agent, my agent, about is this even going to work? But Lori is always the person who reads it once it's at least a proposal that has some shape to it. But I think it's because I'm not an expert yet when I'm writing the proposal, I have to talk to a couple of experts because some of the questions, I mean, there's this one big question in the proposal for this book. And there was a very real chance that one of the experts was going to say, well, you can't answer that because we've been trying to answer that question since Aristotle or whatever. And no one has a good answer to that question. And I don't think it will ever be answered or something like that. You know, you could see that mm-hmm. would just be too much to bite off and chew on a proposal like that. So that would be really helpful feedback for me.
Serena, have you ever let go of an idea because you've gotten, you know, or you talked it out and we're like, yeah, actually, no.
You know, sure, I'm sure I have, but not enough times, you know, that that I would say that it's a thing that's, you know, been a problem for me. I do keep in the back of every one of my planners, the last few pages are dedicated to a page that's called One Line Ideas Here.
I love that.
And it has a lot of ideas on it. I love that.
Well, the book is a whole year long, kids.
Yes.
You know, like, and I'm on page, at the bottom of page 3. But the funny thing about this is that if you read through here exhaustively, that I'm, you know, forgetful. So you'll see another, like on page 2, you'll see a repeat, or it's really close to something I wrote on page 1. So if you can, you know, sort of track why an idea pokes mm-hmm. you and then somebody shoots it down, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, if it comes back to you anyway, it's like, set it free. But, you know, sometimes they fly back and they're like, no, that guy was just wrong.
That page would be sort of the epitome of, you know, Anne Lamott talks about, you know, not wanting to get hit by a bus because someone will see a rough draft and think she's just terrible. If someone were to read my, if I had that last page, which I'm absolutely going to now that I have my new planner for next year, if someone were to see that page, it would look like, you know, those weird notes you write to yourself in the middle of the night and you wake up and you're like, what did I mean by gummy bears in the freezer or whatever? For me, it would be words like jumping snake worms and, you know, things like that. And it would just make no sense to anyone, but it makes sense to me. And those are the ideas that I think the genesis of those ideas are really, really valuable, because they, for me anyway, often two of them, Stephen King actually does talk about this too. Carrie began as two separate ideas. One about the idea mm-hmm. he read somewhere that that girls tend to get more powers of ESP. Like, if it's going to happen, it happens during puberty. And then he had another idea about a girl's bathroom and girls pelting each other with tampons and pads and yelling at each other about getting their first period. And it was like, blammo, there's those two ideas that come together. And suddenly he has not just a one-liner, but an actual book idea. And I think that's why I love having those little one-liners. I think they often, for me anyway, come together.
I think the value in this process maybe isn't about having people shoot it down, like, mm-hmm. but in talking it, in verbalizing it yourself. So maybe if you're better at verbalizing it by writing it down, then that's all you have to do.
I find myself often verbalizing it to another person and then trailing off in the middle of my sentence because my brain is running with the idea. And then they're like, hello, do you need my input on something? And I'm not even in the room anymore. I've talked about it, my brain has gone off on a flight of fancy and I'm sort of off finishing the idea in my head. It's not fun having me around when I'm deep into an idea. I don't make much sense, honestly, I have to say. Serena, the thing I've loved about the books you've written and the way you've written them is you are fully willing to admit to us anyway that some of the ideas you've had for books have really scared you, that an idea or a protagonist or a circumstance that you're going to put one of your protagonists in scares you. And over again, I've said this, that the books that have scared you the most, I think, have been some of your best books. And I love the fact that you'll get these ideas and you'll find ways to make really challenging plot points or characters or whatever work. That's one of the things I love most about your work.
Well, thank you. I have been trying to pay attention lately to the scale of a premise. So the scale of an idea. So you're writing an essay about an idea you had that's essay sized, mm-hmm. you know? And a lot of books in popular fiction, you can write a rom-com that has like low stakes, like the world's not ending. There's no meteor running for the, you know, or you can write a big premise. And one of the things that happens to me is that I have a big idea, but I write in a very realistic world. So I have a huge premise and then I fight it for 300 pages and make it, you know, smaller and fit into the more rational world. So not only do we have to figure out what ideas are the most exciting to us, then you have to scale them and, you know, see how they fit into
Can I ask you about a couple of things that have appeared in your books that I can only assume you ran across just in the normal course of like reading the news or watching hockey? Things like,
of course,
replacement goalies. In one story, you have someone who gets to be like a, I don't know what they call them, but like a volunteer goalie when no one else can do it. And that's like at the crux of this book. And I have to just assume that at one point you sort of like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Or you know, the way that a college might deal with a sexual assault violation and how some colleges weren't equipped to do that in the right way. Do you have those ideas and just kind of have them brewing in the back of your head and then fit them into a larger concept? Or does that become your larger concept?
Well, the things that end up on my one-line ideas page and those things that you're bringing up are always the stuff that I click on in the newspaper. You know, I click on a certain kind of article above another one. Like, I'm clicking on anything to do with cybersecurity because that's really interesting to me. Those fun, like, human interest stories come up in hockey all the time where, you know, somebody, some 42-year-old electrician gets to sit on the bench for one period of the game because the goalie got food poisoning or whatever. You know, those are the things that excite me in the news, and that's how that stuff makes it in there. And of course, the way colleges handle sexual assault claims is a real mess, and it's so complicated. You know, there's so many ways they can go about fulfilling that mission, and some of them are just a wreck. So, you know, yeah, that stuff just percolates with me and I care about it in real life and it makes it into books, hopefully in the right sized way.
Some of us dorks like me, I like bigger chunks of like the pay disparities between women in hockey and men in hockey. I totally geeked out over that stuff when you wrote all about that. But I could see how not everyone would like maybe like a table, you know, see figure six of the table of pay disparity. I would love it. But, you know, that's me.
Yeah, I've got a lot of that in my book for March 2022. It's another female athlete. And it's a good time. Like, you know, the men's in the sport are like thoroughbreds, you know, their every need is met. And then the women are making $700 a week and they hold practice on the ice after the men are finished with it. Like, that's great conflict. Yeah. And that's what saves a story from just being another like meet cute. And that, you know, the internal conflict of, oh, we should we or shouldn't we? Like, you don't need to mess around with those well-trodden things if you've got some real life conflict, you know, tearing up the
That's
page.
That's funny you say that, because the thing that really stuck with me in one of your books was that, you know, under the rules, men and women would have to have the same, it was about the bathrooms. And so you had all kinds of like frilly, girly, wonderful smelling things in the men's restroom. Normally what we'd think about is the fact that the women's bathroom or locker room would have to have the same level of things that the men's bathroom had. But you pulled the opposite where suddenly, well, the equal and opposite, where you did that. But you also made sure that the men had to have all the good smelling things because that would make their locker room equal to the women's locker room. I love that kind of stuff.
Well, that was just me having fun, because with when you write ideas in a sequence, like you have to come up with another novel shaped idea, right? And it has to be about the right size and shape, but it also has to be familiar and different. So I'm on book 8 or something in that series, and every book has to have some like locker room hijinks in it that are nothing like the hijinks from the last book. And that's how you end up talking about like the men trying to identify what flower is in their shampoo, because, you know, we haven't gone there yet. So
that is the fun stuff. Fun. And actually, there was a moment like that in one of the bromance book clubs where they were talking about how to approach having a massage that just made me laugh out loud. And it's those small moments that really make me laugh. So, KJ, we have gone way off tangent on your big idea here,
no!
But I am fascinated by the minutia of how Serena comes up with her ideas and these very true moments that happen in her books. It just fascinates me.
Well, I would have to say that it has always been, it's, Serena was probably the first to turn to me while we were walking and say, so, I have a plot problem. But once she did it, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to, like, this is good. And then it's just, I think because I'm really focusing on coming up with a third book, and I have not had this experience of like sort of making up a book out of whole cloth. I mean, they're all made out of whole cloth, but you know, the others have had ideas that have niggled at me or have been sticking with me. And while I have that this time, it's just not as powerful because, you know, it hasn't been wandering through my brain for 15 years. So yeah, I'm just really wanted to explore how important it is to get some input from others on whether your idea is, as you said, a novel-sized idea or, you know, a premise-sized idea or an essay-sized idea.
It's because every book written is all about choices. Like, if you're going to make chapter two about this thing, then chapter two can't be about something else. And making every one of those choices is so hard at the beginning of a project because literally anything is possible. And that's why I'm in favor of keeping the door open when I'm writing, because sometimes I need to talk and say, hey, if I make this choice in chapter two, I'm going down this path. You know, tell me if you think it's the right corridor.
Right.
I'm going to be coming to both of you at some point if I end up finishing this novel that I've been working on, because what I need is that sort of second act tension. And I don't know what that's going to be yet. I haven't figured it out. And I don't know that I can trust that it's just going to fall into my lap. And the thing I've gained from watching you, KJ, and you, Serena, is sometimes you have to manufacture the tension. And sometimes you have to make sure that this character is in that place so that that can happen. And I've never done that before. So I'm going to be writing with the door open because I need you for those things. I'm going to need help.
It's very much a marionette's job. You know, you have to, you're pulling the levers to move the puppet over here.
I guess it would be easier. Yep. It would be easier, I suppose, you know, if you could just, you know, channel the muses and the words flow out of you as if you're dictating. But I guess that's just...
Well, you know, the words do flow out. Yeah. It's just that they aren't necessarily useful words. It's like I have a muse practical joker or something. Because I actually wouldn't have any problem. Like, I could sit down right now and write lots and lots of pages of this very loose idea that I have. And I think for some people, that's a great way to get to the end. And it is what I... But it's what I did last time. And it's just not... I don't like it.
For an essay.
I would like to try something different.
For an essay, it's very useful because I'm only sinking, you know, let's say the essay is max 4,000 words. Maybe I'll sink 8,000 words of effort, but that's not a book. We're talking about something very different when we're talking about an essay. And actually, speaking of which, we have to leave a fair amount of time for books because I have, and actually this is a plot thing too that I'd like to talk about because both of my books, I have some added commentary to talk about. So I want to make sure we have plenty of time for books at once we're done.
Well, let's do it. Okay. Let's talk about what we've been reading. And it sounds like you need to go.
Yeah, I have two biggies and two people. I'm not going to feel bad at mentioning the authors and the problems I had with the books because both of them can take it. Number one.
Okay.
Number one, we have, and I tweeted about this already, I have an advanced listener copy of David Sedaris's part two of his diaries called A Carnival of Snackeries, which I love the title. I love, you know, I was so excited. I have been waiting for this. For me, David's listening to David Sedaris is very much a comfort thing for me. He can help me go to sleep. I like getting familiar enough with it that I can use it as a way to calm my anxiety. He really, listening to David Sedaris over the past, through the pandemic has really helped me with my anxiety. So I was very much looking forward to this new material. And then the introduction starts, and he explains that a lot of people get very upset with him because they say, oh, I really love his writing, but then he got that old lady to read it because he sounds like a woman, and lots of people assume that he is a woman. And so he decided, since he doesn't do accents as well, and a lot of this is takes place in England, and people think he's a woman anyway, that 50% of the book is going to be narrated by Tracy Ullman. So 50% of the new diaries are David Sedaris, and 50% of the diaries are Tracy Ullman. Here's the problem. I'm not hearing David Sedaris when Tracy Ullman is reading David Sedaris's work. And she voices in a couple of the pieces his father. And I'm sorry, but no one should be voicing Lou Sedaris but David Sedaris, or Lou Sedaris, but he's dead now. It took me way out of it. And actually, every time Tracy Ullman narrates, my brain immediately thinks I'm listening to Amy Sedaris. So it's very confusing. It's jarring. Tracy Ullman's fantastic. Do not get me wrong. Tracy Ullman is wonderful. But the magic, my favorite Stephen King novels are narrated by Stephen King. My favorite David Sedaris is narrated by David Sedaris. And I just, for me, it was hugely disappointing. Although I will say, I really enjoyed the content. The content's fantastic. It goes all the way through 2020. So we get his view of, you know, the pandemic and Trump and all sorts of other interesting things. Really great in terms of content. So if you're reading it off the page, this doesn't apply to you. But if you're listening to it, you're going to have, it was a mental stumbling block for me.
Well, that's really funny because that I am not an audiobook listener, but this is one I would have gotten on audio because I like to listen to Derek David Sedaris on audio because, you know, I'm used to listening to him. Yep. He narrates his own stuff on This American Life and other places. And like you said, it's a familiar experience, but I don't want to hear somebody else read it.
And here's the other thing. In the last couple of books, he has aged the way he says he gives his father's he says his father's words, like if he's quoting his father or speaking as his father, he has, as his father gets into his 90s, has slowed and deepened, and he voices it beautifully. He does such a great job. And so the last thing I wanted, knowing that his dad was reaching the end of his life, was to suddenly have Tracy Ullman take that experience away from me. So
that really is an interesting choice.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was my problem with that.
As you said, David Sedaris can take our criticism of his choice. Yes. He'll be okay.
My next one that I have to bring up is also, I had an advance audio of Paula Hawkins. It's out now. Paula Hawkins, A Slow Fire Burning, her new one. She wrote Girl on the Train, which was fine. And then one after that that I didn't read. And this new one, A Slow Fire Burning. Thank you, Libro.fm. That's where I got it. So I read a review of it that perfectly encapsulates the, I didn't hate it. I actually stuck with it to the end. I was engaged to the end, but she did this very strange thing where she was all over the place with her timelines and all over the place with who the point of view was, changing the power structure, making weak characters powerful and making powerful characters weak. And I could stay on top in the audio of who was speaking. I don't know on the page if it's different, like if they make it a clear indication of who's speaking and when we are, but it's very difficult from a timeline perspective to keep track of where you are. And here's the kicker. Here's the thing that really got me. She mimics the structure, this chaotic all over the place timeline and voicing point of view. She mimics that because the novel within a novel has that plot structure and the critics pan it for having that plot structure. So she acknowledges inside of her own book that this story doesn't work because it's chaotic, it's all over the place, and it's voiced by many different characters. And yet she, knowing, like, she constructed the world in which the critics pan the book that uses the exact structure that she chooses to use in A Slow Fire Burning. So all of that said, I stuck with the whole book. I listened to it on 2 4-hour drives. I enjoyed it. I guessed one whodunit, and it and I was slightly wrong, and I was surprised. It was really weird, though. So be prepared if you want to try something new and different. This is new and different. Some critics really hated it. For Kirkus did not like it. But I came to it with that before I'd read the Kirkus review and found it a challenge, but also a fun listen. So I want to ask her. Well, I want to ask her. Like, you decided to do this thing, and you panned yourself in your own book. Like, you criticized yourself for your own structure in your book, and said the critics hated this book because of, and that you chose to do that anyway. Like, did you? I would be very interested to hear like what her choices were. So anyway, those are my two. Those are my two rants and raves for the day. Because they're really both. Both of them are both. So, yeah.
Right. Well, mine was, mine's just a plain ordinary rave, but it is a funny one. So I read and enjoyed The Bookshop of Second Chances by Jackie Fraser, or Fraser, I don't know, but it's spelled F-R-A-S-E-R. And what it is, I texted both of you about the minute I put down, if somebody had read Confessions of a Bookseller, as we have, and thought to themselves,
Diary of a Bookseller.
And also maybe, I'm sorry, Diary, well, there's both, Diary of a Bookseller. I think there's, this. He's got a second one, Confessions of a Bookseller. And in it, he has a fraught relationship with an American woman named Anna, or I think that's not her real name, who also has written a book about her fraught relationship with the author of Diary of a Bookseller. If you were to read both of those books and think to yourself, man, I could make a heck of a rom-com out of this, that's what this book is. And I mean that with love and delight. It's actually better than the rom-com that you would write if you just took their books, but it is satisfying and entertaining, and so that character, and so a bookstore in Scotland, and it even mentions Wigtown, which is where the other bookstore is. I really enjoyed it as a book, and also found it very entertaining from a perspective of, you went there, and she totally makes it her own. Like, it's not, it's not like I, you know, rewrote the story of your romance or something like that at all. And yet. So if you loved Diary of a Bookseller and you like rom-coms,
by Sean Bythel,
let
by
me
the
suggest,
way.
Yes, let me suggest going to get The Bookshop of Second Chances.
That's really cool. That's really interesting. It's always interesting also that there are these ideas that sort of bounce around in the zeitgeist and show up in lots of different places. In fact, I can't ruin the story, but the book, The Plot, that we've already talked about, or we talked about at one point, also shares an attribute of in Slow Fire Burning. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. They had to have been writing these at the same time because they both just came out around the same time, and yet they share something in the plot that's identical. It's really interesting to me that there's these ideas seem to come out at the same time.
Well, or it's, I mean, it's just also fun that sometimes somebody writes a book. Well, I mean, take Tokyo Ever After, which was the Reese Witherspoon YA pick over the summer. And it's so fun and so entertaining and so absolutely 100% Princess Diaries if it were in Tokyo. Hmm. Like, that's what it is. But there's no... And that's apparent. I mean, it was fine with me as a reader. I really enjoyed The Princess Diaries. I also really enjoyed this. And it seems to be fine with everyone else. So I kind of, I found that super intriguing because I would have a hard time writing that.
Yeah.
If I thought to myself, ooh, you know, The Princess Diaries in Tokyo, I'd be like, oh, but I can't.
Right.
So it's really interesting to me where the line is, where the point is that the answer is, oh, but I can, because I liked that book. I think I would have had the same thought with, you know, this could become a rom-com. Mm-hmm. I would have been like, oh, but, you know, it's somebody's real memoir. And it's not that close.
Yeah.
But it's pretty close.
Well, there are only so many ideas out there. There are only so many stories out there in the world. And we all recycle, and all new is recycled, I think. So anyway, so that's the joy in writing.
Yep.
And there are some stories I can read, like, as Serena will attest, there are some formulas / books / plots that I could just read over and over and over again and never, ever tire of them. So that's fine with me.
Absolutely. You want to stick a rom-com in a cake baking competition and I will read it. That's fine with me. But the funny part to me is that as a writer, I think to myself, oh, but I can't because someone already has. And that's just not the way to think about it. Perhaps this is another episode.
Yep.
Oh, okay. But I can't.
All right.
Yes, you can.
All right. We'll think about that then. Anyone have anything to add? Nope. Serena's shaking her head. Okay.
Another great conversation. If any of you listeners out there have a burning writing question that you would like us to either talk about or maybe even have you on board to discuss and see if we can help you solve. We're still taking requests on that front. Can't promise to answer everybody, but we'll see what we can do to get some universal topics in here and have some interesting conversations about it. You can email at us at amwriting@substack.com. Wait, is that an email address? It's not an email address.
Yeah, amwriting@substack.com. Yeah, that's an email address.
No. Is it?
I guess we got to be prepared for that because we've screwed it up now 3 times. I also wanted to say you can go, the ideas really keep flowing at the #AmWriting Facebook group. We continue to get new ideas there. We've already used a couple of them and we're going to be moving forward with a couple of those ideas as well. So if you have any burning issues, any problems you're having, any advice you need, please do not hesitate to join the #AmWriting Facebook group and put your ideas in there. And in the meantime, you may receive all kinds of helpful feedback anyway, because the people in there are so helpful and so kind and so lovely, and we kick all the mean people out. So you can't be mean there. So it's good. All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The #AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.